Hello and welcome to another episode of Coffee with Candace. I'm your host, Candace Mama. This week, I am bringing you not one, but two phenomenal guests. Why? Because it's my birthday. And all I ask as a birthday gift is that if you like this podcast, you like, share, or subscribe, or do all of them. That would be amazing. So who are my guests? I'm speaking to researcher at Queen's University Belfast, Dr. Drew Mikkel, about the Lebanon crisis. I am also speaking to Monroe France, who is New York University's Associate Vice President for Global Inclusion. And both of them are going to give us context on how to be better global citizens, because is that not what the world needs right now? So without further ado, here are my incredible guests.
I want to speak about you. Enough about me and my birthday.
Okay.
I want to speak about you, Drew. Firstly, I want to thank you just for taking time to speak to me. I mean, just like following your post for a couple of weeks, it's also opened me up. It's opened me up to a conversation I haven't had. And it's very important for citizens to engage, to be active, and to understand different climates. And so I want to start first, you know, there. I want to start, you know, to people who don't know what's going on in Lebanon, you know, I mean, people know about the big explosion in Beirut, but, you know, for a beginner's guide, for example, what would you say to us?
So I would say that what happened in Beirut, which I think most of everyone in the world knew, because officially it came in as the fourth largest explosion of all time. What happened there was not just symptomatic and symbolic of decades worth of political mismanagement, corruption, and a political elite class that had focused whenever Lebanon's civil war had ended in 1990 and they were put in place. This elite political class focused on dividing people along the 18 different religious communities that are recognized in Lebanon. So in each political elite represented a particular community. And in that representation, they took the idea to divide people by not focusing on reconciliation during a very long and bloody war, by ignoring all forms of transitional justice, by focusing on making sure that they could put themselves and their nearest cronies in the center of the state and then to capture the entire institutions so they could then dish out their own to their clients and their own rewards, and then to replicate their own power through decades. And the problem that we've seen is that, having lived in Beirut for a couple of different times, it's not a very safe place because the infrastructure is gone of the state, or it's crumbling, and it fulfills this weird public-private enterprise that at the center of the public-private enterprises are these elite politicians who have not only captured the state, but captured things like the banks and captured things like public transport and have shares across the board. So really, in the end, what you have is a recipe for these communal leaders to make sure that they are never held accountable ever, as long as they always, and we have seen in the last week where a number of key politicians have come out and threatened that they are the reason why there is no civil war. You've been to Northern Ireland. You were here on our 20th anniversary. That's where we met. And what happens in these post-conflict societies, of course, of which you're sitting in one right now, is that there usually becomes a fear of going back. There's a fear of retreating to that space that was so terrible. But in that, the creation of that fear, what we have is an inability to move past what has divided us previously, and that we become so focused on being stable. And in Lebanon, we did that since the end of the 30 years since the end of the Civil War. And in that time, they captured the state and they completely crumbled it around us. So we always knew that something like this, I mean, whenever the explosion happened, in my heart, despite the fact that the region is, you know, not it's fragile, not the most stable, I knew that I just felt a sense that it was because of this gross incompetence, which you can see every day walking through that.
I mean, coming from a post-country, I know exactly what you're speaking of, which is fear-mongering, in many ways, right? Because when most of the population is living in fear, how they vote and how they make decisions based off fear. So are there any opposition, like opposition parties worth even engaging with or entertaining at the
So that's a really good question. So in the since Lebanon in had its largest cross-community, cross-class, cross-gender, cross-sexuality protest in October 2019, called the October Revolution. And one of the key slogans of that revolution was Killon Yani Killon, which means all means all. All these communal leaders that were embedded in the state and have used, and again, another similarity between Northern Ireland, Lebanon, and South Africa is the use of a power-sharing system that has placed these elites post-conflict in power. So they engage in the elite political game at the very top, and the space for other emerging actors, of which there are many in Lebanon, is not in that political field. So whenever you have these actors who are more egalitarian, not confessional, not, you know, dividing by ethnic conflict or the past, they retreat into the civil society spaces because that's the only place that they can gain any kind of foothold in the system or in public discourse. You have had small parties and small individual people who try to come through. But as you said, that fear-mongering, that ability to scapegoat, Lebanon has hosted 1.5 million Syrian refugees since the conflict in neighboring Syria. And the Syrian refugees became an excuse for these elites for a large time to point out all the ills of Lebanon were on these poor, disenfranchised people who were just fleeing conflict. So you're right that fear-mongering always keeps up, and it's always a way to keep them in power. And they keep, not only do they keep themselves in power, they keep any other actors from emerging by making sure the electoral system suits them, by capturing the state institutions, and limiting, like, at times, unfortunately, limiting freedom of expression in the country as well.
Jeez. And so with the explosion, has this like catapulted a change? Do you feel like a change happened from this moment?
Lebanon has been through a lot. So as I mentioned, in 2019, we had this large protest that was actually the feeling of it was very, very positive. I was there in November. I took part. And there is a sense of finally, we've seen protests in Lebanon before, but oftentimes they get diverted through the fear mongering or through scapegoating by the elites, and they get captured and they get off track, or they're maybe not quite across the classes, or they're across different regions. In Lebanon, 2019, we saw everyone take part, everyone, which was great. Everyone pointed at their own communal leaders and said, "You're all responsible for this mess." However, at that point, it was a very jovial feeling. There was a sense of aspiration, of hope. And in the preceding time since October, we had COVID and we've had lockdown and we've had hyperinflation that is akin to Zimbabwe right now in Lebanon. So people's spending power, they can't retract money because the politicians have illegally decided they're not allowed to retract money and take dollars out from their accounts. So myself dealing with this lockdown and all my closest friends and family that still live in Lebanon, we've been dealing with a deep malaise because of what's been happening through that mismanagement. And the Lebanese have always been famed for their resilience. They've been through multiple civil wars. Like my grandfather went through an Ottoman, First World War, Second World War, multiple civil wars, 4 kidnappings. And this is a very stereotypical story of the Lebanese who stayed in Lebanon because of the region, multiple invasions by different countries. And we're famed for resilience. But at one point, this idea of bouncing back from the systemic violence that's enacted upon people or that has been regionally brought to Lebanon's doorstep, at some point, the resilience has to stop. And it has stopped now. And the explosion was, unlike in 2019, October 2019, where there was a joyful rebellion against the class, now it's rage, absolute rage about what has happened. For obvious reasons, it's a case of, and this is where I think that in talking about being a global citizen and supporting each other, we're pro-social creatures by necessity. We cannot live without one another, without support, without love, without care, without empathy, without compassion. And we have had leaders who have for years and decades claimed that they were protecting their community. But they weren't protecting their community. Clearly, they, through their negligence, criminal and sociopathic negligence, left chemicals by the port of Beirut, a busy port of Beirut, to explode. So this showed the ball. This showed that they were only out for themselves, that they have disassociated from even protecting their own confessions and their own groups. So that reaction has been utter rage, and justifiably so.
Mm. And I was speaking to someone else, Andrea France, was also speaking about the idea of resilience. And, you know, in certain communities, it's almost like people are pacified, either they're in poverty or they are in, you know, post-conflict communities. They're pacified with certain words. They separate from having resilience and being able to smile and all that kind of stuff, so that real change doesn't have to. It's like, oh, they're so good at this. They keep going through it. And I know with the news cycle, the dangerous thing about the news is the fact that it moves on, right? So Lebanon was in the news around the world for a certain period of time. And now, of course, the news cycle is moving up, outrageous, and so on and so forth. So for you, when you see a global community, right, you see people from different parts of the world, what is it that you want people to do? What is it that you want people to, I know, education, but what else can we do to feel like we are impacting change?
How abstract would you like me to go?
I mean, you go.
Well, I really wanted to talk to you because obviously, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, I've read the book a while ago, and I do a lot of work with former combatants as well. I'm a member of a board in Lebanon of a group of former combatants who fought during the Lebanese Civil War, whose now duty is to talk to young people about their experiences of division and how they came to forgiveness and how they came to understand that violence wasn't the way. So whenever I talk, whenever you mentioned about what we can do, several things. I'm guided by the fact of my history that I'm both from Northern Ireland and from Lebanon, that I grew up between Belfast and Beirut, that I have inherently inbuilt with me a sense of cosmopolitanism. But I'm always reminded that, you know, Socrates quote that I'm neither Athenian nor Greek, but a citizen of the world. My belief is that we have to be aggressively, compassionate about the systemic violence that is going on around the world, the systemic inequality that is going on around the world, and seek to actually take away divisions and flags and see into the actual understanding of people, their experiences, their lived experiences, their empathy, what they are suffering. So I think that we've unfortunately, as we've seen the rise of the global right, particularly prominently in the last decade and a half or half decade, we've seen people trying to place more flags. And we're seeing people trying to place more pillars that refugees aren't allowed to cross the channel. They aren't allowed to escape poverty or violence at home. This becomes a case of enforced tribalism. But I was reminded by the first, we unfortunately in Northern Ireland had the death of the Nobel Peace Prize winner, John Hume, and who helped create peace here. And he was the first politician that I ever, as a young boy, mostly growing up in Belfast, his message resonated with me. And one particular message that I take every day into my own work and into my own life is that you can't eat, quote, you can't eat a flag. No one can eat a flag. And so whether you're Hutu or Tutsi, you're Sunni or Shia or Maronite, you're Catholic or Protestant, Dinka or Nuer, either in the end, what matters is your ability to access justice, the ability to be able to have a happy life free of violence or systemic inequality. So when you say education, I agree 100%. We have to be educated about the systems of inequality that affect all of us. But we also have to be compassionate to others. Now, that doesn't mean that, of course, I'm aware that not everyone could have, because I've been a mess the last couple of weeks after Beirut, quite frankly, because I'm from there. I've lived in that city. I've loved and I've lost in that city. The greatest friends that I could ever hope for have come from that city. So it affects me personally. It's the same way I could have sympathy for a friend's loved one dying, but not feel all that pain myself. we can't go through our daily lives feeling the personal pains of everyone, because we wouldn't be able to do anything. But that doesn't mean that we can't have empathy and compassion for the things that are going on, and realize that racial inequality in South Africa mirrors with racial inequality in America. We can't see that we can't have solidarity with the protests that are going, that were going on after George Floyd, and not see resemblance and uniform connectivity between all of us in the world. For me, that's what it means to be a global citizen, and what it means to have compassion and solidarity. You sending me a message about what you can do to help in the aftermath of the, me sending a list of organizations and getting the word out to understand that there's more than enough love and space in our hearts to be able to appreciate the struggles of others. Because as soon as we start to disassociate the struggles of others, that isn't our problem, then we're actually going against our better, the best part of our human nature.
Oh, love that. I think you touched on something I usually, you know, speak of, otherness. Whenever you look at anyone else, a marginalized community or any community crisis, and you view them as other, and you're like, oh, but I'm not directly impacted by it, therefore, right? Then it becomes a crisis, not just for you, it becomes a crisis for your community, a crisis for your community, a crisis around you. Because what the one about life is, it ebbs and flows, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, Lebanon is going through a crisis, but it's not going to be here forever. Someday, you know, it might be South Africa. Someday it might be France. And I think when you start adopting the mentality that everyone else in the world is hurting as and is in pain because of a systematic or, you know, badly governed, or because of their skin tone or anything, it affects you directly, you know, and you may not, as you said, feel that pain as you would, you know, a personal loved one, but feeling the pain of others allows us to unify and allows us to, we can move forward. And so coming back to Lebanon as it stands today, what have been the, you know, because I know a lot of people don't know what's happening right now. Side of the explosion, a lot of people aren't aware of what's happening with the rebuilding, what's happening with, you know, people's homes at the moment.
So what you had in the immediate aftermath was another indictment of the political class, and the fact that private citizens were the people who came out to clean up. Private citizens were sweeping up the glass. There was little, next to absolutely zero help from official government sources. So what you had in the immediate aftermath was the same with that famed word, and I don't like it either because we often use it for inaction and resilience. The Lebanese showed their resilience, but at some point it turned into anger with live protests, large protests in downtown Beirut, which the government's first reaction was to, or forces of the government and the army and different security apparatuses, were to use incessant tear gas to try and suppress what was happening. The government resigned, firstly, in the next 48 hours after the explosion, the government had resigned very quickly. So we're now in the part of the political stage of Lebanon where the large political actors that I characterized earlier are starting to try and see how they can rework the system to their advantage by nominating a new prime minister, by nominating a new government. And the people on the ground are firmly rejecting the current nominations and are firmly have an antithesis towards the fact that, again, Lebanon's in another cycle where the elites who got us to the point where this explosion happened are starting to try and chart their journey again. So in terms of the rebuilding, on the more human side, there, I mean, the post-traumatic stress, the PTSD that people have suffered, because of the large explosion, the amount of glass that was destroyed, one of the human aspects of what's happened is that you hear stories about people who are now dreaming of the sound of glass being swept away. For now, nearly, and all the, there is a number of missing that are from the explosion that are nearly all found. But there are still some people that are being looked for and are still not found. So we're still not even dealing with a post-reconstruction. We're not dealing with, okay, now everyone's been found, now the ordinance has been cleared, now all the buildings are being declared safe. We're at the point what we're still trying to find if everyone's alive or who is alive and who is missing. So before even going on to rebuilding the city, of which there has been an estimated 15 billion worth of damage, and considering the economic crisis beforehand, we can appreciate that that's going to be a very difficult and long road. And additionally, without a government, we can't negotiate with outside, with the IMF or the World Bank, the economic stimulus package that is required to stop Lebanon completely tanking. So economically, because of the hyperinflation, a lot of people can't even afford the basic necessities to pay in Lebanese lira for toothpaste is equivalent to $40 at this point because of the hyperinflation. And most of the country, around about 75% of the country, is paid in Lebanese lira. So people are basically being handed monopoly money for their daily lives. So we have this confluence of issues that the country is trying to deal with right now. So it's very, and this is why I still continue to push and talk about what's going to happen and actually push for donations, because there's still issues with clearance, there's still issues with rebuilding, and there's still issues with a health care system that was on the verge of collapse before this. Before this crisis, it was estimated it was 11 days from collapse. So all these issues are still ongoing now.
That's heartbreaking. And I want to know, because I mean, COVID is also in the, so it's not like, you know, this is happening in isolation. What's already going on globally. First thing I want to know, has the person responsible for the explosion been held to account, prison, or did he just get?
So I mentioned earlier that the government has nominated some sacrificial lambs within the Port Authority who have been responsible. But as the very good reporting has shown, the President of the Republic knew about this 3 weeks before it happened. Not only that, 11 different institutions, effectively the higher echelons of the Lebanese government, knew about, they were handed a report that said this ammonium nitrate is in very, very dangerous condition. It's been held here for 7 years and it's not being stored properly. And this amount, nearly 3,000 tons of it, is a disaster waiting to happen. So the entire system knew. They absolutely knew, and they're all responsible for this because they sat on their hands and knees, and there's been some very good timelines about showing what was done since the report was landed on the president's desk. At not any point did he say publicly, he's claimed that he has no executive authority to do anything, and while the president of the republic is mostly a ceremonial role, he absolutely has the ability to publicly say this is a very dangerous situation and expect an institution to do something. But him saying that is a way of passing the buck from who is really to blame, which is the entire system itself and these corrupt elite leadership. Oh. So they have some sacrificial lambs who may go through a process and be jailed. It's everyone on the street knows that it's not just them who are at fault. It's the entire political class and the entire system.
Oh man. And I know in South Africa we have, you know, we have a very big divide, both the have nots and the haves. And so you could literally see it from our richest suburb being right to our poorest community. And I want to know, how is the Lebanon infrastructure, is it built in a similar way? It's such a huge disparity.
There is a huge disparity, and Beirut is a good place to see it. In the aftermath of the civil war, I mentioned earlier about this nebulous space where political elites found themselves using private funding and private donors and private investment and their public position to give contracts and to secure contracts for people. So one of the one of the sort of interesting things that happened at the end of the Lebanese Civil War was this sort of regeneration of downtown Beirut that was screened throughout the world during the 70s and 80s. As death and destruction. And what had happened in the immediate aftermath of the Lebanese Civil War is the immediate downtown area had been regenerated, but it had been regenerated by a then prime minister who had his contracts from Saudi and from the Gulf states be able to come in and build these, most of the time, god-awful complexes and high-rise buildings. It became completely unaffordable because it was all foreign investment that was propping it up. became completely unaffordable for the average Lebanese person on the day-to-day. So you see in Lebanon that it's a very expensive city to live in. Beirut is a very expensive city to live in. And you see the difference in class. You will walk down the street and oftentimes you'll see a Lamborghini and supercars and people driving around who are, you know, maybe just in from the Gulf States after making a lot of money and investing in the country. So the country is their own playground, versus someone who will just drive a 60-year-old Mercedes as a taxi or as a communal taxi. You see this juxtaposition in Beirut on the day-to-day basis of the haves and the have-nots. And that has been as a direct consequence of the economic policy of the current political class.
Oh, man. And one thing I always speak about, when people are hungry and people are living on the verge of, you know, starvation and making enough money to eat, it's very difficult for them to make informed decisions. It's very difficult for them to even think of anything else of, you know, where's my meal coming from? How am I going to feed my family? You know, rent, all those kind of things. And so, I mean, in a perfect city, if you could go in and overhaul the system, what are some things that you'd begin with that would be so important for the country, right?
If I could, am I being given a magic wand or...
A magic wand of humans.
Yeah, what we can do. I mean, there's the fact is that on a personal level, I've settled myself into a long fight for Lebanon. Before this explosion, I had started the process of just giving up on the country because it got so bad, and the country was going to suffer a significant, and it will still suffer a significant brain drain. The best people who have tried to change the country and tried to reform see no future, and it always produces because it has a very good higher education system that might also actually collapse. It's produced a number of usually trilingual people who are excellently qualified, and unfortunately, that's going to leave. So what has to happen now in Lebanon is that we have to commit ourselves to a long fight to uproot this political class that has embedded itself. And one of the ways that we uproot them in the medium term is by establishing systems, independent systems of accountability. One of my best friends, he's an executive director of a media freedoms organization, and they've established this program that will look to create a really independent media that, because in Lebanon, most of the media is owned by the political parties, so they all have their channel, spitting out their own views, supporting and propping up their own agenda, but a real independent media, along with independent judiciary, and accountability, and anti-corruption measures, would be one way of highlighting the fact that this class has expanded the public services of states and put all their cronies in there. So, and just engage in public corruption and stealing from the state directly. What we need is systems around that are independent, that can uproot them and show them and be accountable to them and be accountable to the street, to the Lebanese street, to the Lebanese people who are aware that the bureaucracies don't work and who are aware that like their everyday lives are being impacted negatively. So that has to be a step one. That's a step two. In the immediate step one is that a new government hopefully negotiates a deal with a new government that's largely independent or largely made up of independents who are not in connection with the political, who then create a new electoral law that gives the opportunity to not be gerrymandered by the political elites who are currently in power, and gives an opportunity for independence with a 30% quota for women as well, and a fair electoral law that actually promotes that independence. So that would be a step one. And then we settle ourselves in for a long fight, all of us, because they're not just going to go quietly into the night. They're not going to give up their prerogatives or their agenda. And then we have to as I said before, they've embedded themselves in the public institutions. That's going to take years and years of uprooting. And it's going to take years of tackling the fear-mongering and the scapegoating. And we need to do that by creating a new political class in Lebanon that actually has a shot at getting into power and winning power and then changing institutions from within.
Oh. And coming in from an external organization like the United Nations or, you know, organization power outside of Lebanon, what do you think those kind of organizations could be doing more to support the Lebanese people and Lebanon as a country?
So one of the things that we saw in the immediate aftermath that was quite pleasing is a commitment by international donor community to not support the Lebanese government. They're not going directly, no external funding is going to go through the Lebanese government, ideally, because that's a site where the money gets captured and it gets filtered into the wrong hands. So this is where the places that I suggested to donate and to continue donation are going directly to the beneficiaries or the beneficiary organizations who will help beneficiaries on the ground. So the international community, we saw yesterday, I don't want to get too much into it because it's a long and quite a sad story, but the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, which was an investigation funded by the international community to a tune of about $1.5 billion, and announced the results of its investigations after over a decade yesterday. And what we've seen is traditionally in the international community, and they've always played an important role in Lebanon, because Lebanon is an accessible place for the rest of the Middle East. So France has always played an important role. Emmanuel Macron was there a couple of days being greeted by a hero in East Beirut. Coming to sort of to the aid when our own politicians sat inside, the French head of state came and was hugging like the victims and survivors. This is a huge message. So, but it also says an important point about Lebanon is that it's always been an important state that you can link to the rest of the region, and global powers have always had their interest, but they've always had a particular interest in keeping it stable. They've always said Lebanon's stable and they is better than it becoming unstable, because if Lebanon becomes unstable, you have direct Saudi versus Iran playing out on Lebanon street, and that will escalate into a wider regional conflict and it becomes much harder to manage. And because we've had an experience of Lebanon 15 years of civil war, they want to avoid that entirely. So the reality is that Lebanon and the international community has to come to a standard where Lebanon is not led by the nose, by the whims of the international community. But the international community is not only interested in stability in Lebanon and empowering those actors who are strongest on the ground, but is actually interested in real deep reform, is interested in promoting those actors who can do it and protecting them, even against the whims of the most powerful ex-warlords and criminals and corrupt politicians right now. And we can get into a wider conversation. We know the international community isn't very good at doing these things, but we've seen what happens whenever we let stability and the idea of Lebanon remaining stable on its current leadership gets us. It gets a huge crater in its capital city.
Oh, if we think of, and you know, the apartheid and how it ended up crumbling. And it does take so much pressure from external forces to initiate that big transformative change in movement. I think the thing is with South Africa, though, where we had, I don't want to say it because it sounds odd, but we had the majority, right? We had the majority of people were groomed within the prison system, so they could come out, take over office, and lead. Whereas in Lebanon, doesn't sound like that is what's happening at the moment, because the firm or stronghold at the top is so deeply embedded in the communities that it's like, okay, we're going to take a breath, need to step back and just coming back to the crisis and what we're dealing with at this very time. You know, I want, as an international citizen and people who are listening to the podcast who really want to help, what are some places that are really doing incredible work on my Instagram, but I know from you, you know, what are some places doing really great work that need money and that need funding?
So this is a good point. I think that our solidarity and the solidarity of the international community can come from a different point, one of which is donation. And I think that one of the places that I've been, when people have asked me, where should I give money? I've said Impact Lebanon is a good one because it coalesces the money and then it gives, and it's giving it out to other organizations. But there's literally a list as long as your arm, and I have it as well, that a friend of mine sent, and we've collected that a couple, and I've added a few different organizations that can look after children. So if people want to commit to looking after children or orphan children or structural rebuilding or looking or refugees, because one thing that's been lost in this is that where the explosion happened was near the port, where it's off, where a large, unfortunately, that was grown up as a slum area that is normally inhabited by a lot of refugees. So a third of the victims have been refugees. So imagine they're suffering themselves. So if that is something that inspires you to give money to, there are organizations to do that. Unfortunately, I would love to be in the position to say that the Lebanese infrastructure has sorted out a lot of different problems, so really channel your money here. But unfortunately, there's such a need, and there was a need because the country was in a complete crisis beforehand. So really, a lot of these emergency institutions are really on their knees. And I think that there's a number of, one thing to look out for is because of the medical supply shortage, because of the economic crisis that was there beforehand, a lot of medicines are actually running out in the country themselves and have run out. So there will be a number of different organizations that you can contribute that can help alleviate that pain as well. But really, unfortunately, it's sad to say that there isn't one area that I would recommend more than others. I think that Impact Lebanon is a good place to start for immediate crisis response and clearing and infrastructural setup as well.
And for people who don't really have maybe the financial means to donate, have right. A social media platform, let's say, what are some things that you want people in the global community to start getting, you know, educated about, start being able to share and, you know, stay informed and inform the community?
See, I think that, you know, this is where the personal sort of idea of solidarity comes from. I mean, for example, there are journalists out there on the ground who have been working nonstop since the explosion because international news took over and they wanted the local journalists. But they're also dealing with incredible emotional stress because they've had their city explode, and then they've been launched into work, and this is going to cause, and one thing, you know, it's close to my heart, mental health generally. So I'm focusing on the fact that I have a phone and I have lots of friends who are from the city, and I'm trying to keep in contact with them to try and at least unburden them and be an ear to talk to. So Lebanese are like Irish, and they're all around the world, and you're going to know some Lebanese around you most likely. So it might be worth the while if you don't have the means, and absolutely, like, we're not all flush with cash, to check in with some Lebanese friends or to understand what ways can you show solidarity, what ways can you engage with the issue, what way can you promote. And we're not all going to be Lebanese experts either, so you're going to be slightly unsure. So it's a good place to check with organizations like Megaphone News, which is a Lebanese organization, by far the best one on the ground, nonpartisan, to understand maybe, and they present their information in really good ways, to sort of maybe read a little bit and share an article, and to support the ongoing popular resistance against the elite political class, because it's going, as I said before, it's going to be a long fight. But also support others and their human needs to be listened to, and actually to unpack their trauma, because there is a significant amount of trauma right now. I mean, just by talking to friends and family and loved ones, what they're dealing with, how they're speaking, how they're thinking about what's happened to them after a year of what has happened to them already. This, you know, whenever we thought it couldn't get any worse, it did. So it's quite a lot of emotional unpacking for people to do. So even if you can happen to be there for someone, then I think that, you know, that's being that global citizen. That's showing that aggressive compassion. It's showing that ability to love others and to start unpacking walls around us and our divisions around us that are so happen to be arbitrarily set by flags and borders.
Well, Drew, thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing with me and allowing me to get a deep understanding. I mean, it is painful and it is a journey, as you said, it'll be a long flight. However, I am an eternal optimist. I think if history is anything to go by, we do know that things always change. So we're holding on to that. And I want to finish on something, you know, about you. I want to ask you, you know, if you could go back to in your old Drew and you could say anything to yourself, what would that be?
It would be hard. I think that be present. The fact is that I may be someone who has always focused on what I've been so scrambling to try and see what I can achieve and what I can do in life that I missed opportunities in front of me. And I'm not saying that opportunities of like the grand opportunities that life presents us, but opportunities to check in with our friends and our loved ones, just to be able to sit with them and to be able to listen to them, to hear their pain, to hear their love, to hear their joy, and to just be present in that moment. I think that we live in an era now, an economic one as well. We live in an environment where it's very fast. We're surrounded by our social media. We're surrounded by what, you know, accomplishments of others. We're surrounded by a whole network that is deliberately looking at like how we should strive for more. But there's very rarely any kind of sense or semblance of how to be still and how to not, you don't need to YOLO your life all the time. You can be still, you can understand, you can seek to get in touch internally. And I have gotten swept up, and I still am swept up, and it's a fight every day to try and tackle that urge to always climb a ladder, always make more of an impact, and actually just meditate, sit on my feelings to understand them and to share love and appreciation with the people around me, and always appreciate the people around me.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I think it's something all of us, I think if you are part of the social media generation, we all need that. You know, it's a constant place for the next thing. Okay,
right. Now this. Yeah, I'm gonna run out of content. It's like, you know, I mean, yeah, exactly. I think that it's really damaging spiritually, emotionally for us. That I don't mind. I think that social media can be an incredible tool. I mean, without social media, you and I wouldn't get to have this conversation, and we wouldn't get to have it out there. But at the heart of it, and why I think that. And unfortunately, I have to mention him, that a good friend of mine who is a wonderful connector, Michael Brooks, he passed away very suddenly this time last month, had a very big podcast in America. And one thing that always inspired me about him was that despite being frenetic and trying to understand global systems of inequality and getting people to speak about it on his podcast, he understood that it was about connecting with other people, connecting with the spirit of other people. Are they doing what they're doing for the right reasons? Are they doing it out of love and compassion? And social media, in the positive sense, has brought us to have this conversation and you to have your many coffees with other people who have that spirit of trying to make a better world and better, more empathetic, spiritually deeper and people. And that's a wonderful mission. And we don't get that. We get wrapped up in like, oh my God, what content are we trying to make? But we're being emotionally truthful to what we want to achieve, whether it's forgiveness or it's trying to have global empathy on my side. And whatever, you know, there's lots of many pieces to fit in. And, you know, that's something that we can all sort of learn a lesson from. So thank you for that. And I really appreciate getting to come on and speak to you, because I admire you so much and all the work that you're doing, and I, you know, I'll support it until the end. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Drew. And I look forward to speaking to you again, you know, and just speak about the work that you do, global empathy, everything that you've done, just, you know, in your career, and you know, love to do that on birthday edition.
Yeah. Well, 3 weeks ago, so we've missed both of our birthdays. So, yeah.
Happy birthday.
And look, thank you again so much for this opportunity. It's wonderful to speak to you. And yeah, your podcast and some of the conversations you've had recently have been very helpful for me on that spiritual, emotional level. So please keep fighting the good fight. And we're in it together. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Drew. And take care of yourself.
You too.
Bye.
Learning about the Lebanon crisis was not something that was easy, simply because I think as many human beings, we want to be a part of the solution. And you can be. You can, you know, donate, you can educate. And as Dr. Drew said, you can be a better ally and just speak and reach out to people you know need you. So as usual, if you have liked this episode, please like, share, subscribe, and rate. I look forward to speaking to you next time.